the Senate Education Committee. We're dealing with Bill number 17, and we also have a CS before you. Not my intention to move it today, but to discuss a little bit further. And if we want to make this amendment, this CS on the floor, we can do that at our next meeting. So we have only one person signed up, I think, to speak, and that's our Dr. Johnson is here with us. You wanted to speak? No? Then we have Patrick Pillay. Is Patrick with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Hi, Patrick. Please go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to start with the PowerPoint slide, and I will start with slide number one, which is our mission statement, because it captures the legislative intent of services we are tasked to provide, and that is A, itinerant outreach services to students with low-incidence disabilities. And low-incidence disabilities is defined as a disability occurring in less than 1% of the total statewide K-12 enrollment. B, instructional support and training of special education personnel, and primarily that's the teachers, paraprofessionals, and parents. And C, other services appropriate to special education. And that includes creation of, for example, e-modules of the 13 categories of special education for the Department of Education's website. And then we'll move on to slide number two. And slide two connects legislative intent to federal law. According to the session laws of Alaska, the Alaska legislature created CSER to do the following. One, make more special education and related services available to students with low incidence disabilities. Two, encourage communities of practice between districts with respect to low-incidence disabilities. Three, make available qualified specialists to school districts to ensure free and appropriate education to students with low-incidence disabilities without regard to their location in the state. And we'll move on to slide number three. Slide three captures CSER's flat funding for the past 14 years. CSER is not linked to the base student allocation. And as a result, we have not received funding increases received by school districts. Since CSER is funded through legislative appropriation, we follow the legislative process in seeking an increase to funding. And that's where we are right now. And we'll move on to slide four. Legislative audit calculated a 36% depreciation of CSER's funding due to the impact of inflation. And this is an adjustment that addresses inflation from 1998 to 2013 and does not factor inflation from 2014 to 2021. Retention of staff is severely impacted, and specialists have rolled over contracts three times without increases. And this includes most of our staff do not have dependent cover insurance. I'm sorry, they do have 70% dependent cover insurance, but 30% out-of-pocket for a family of four is about $800, which makes it very difficult to recruit. And moving on to slide five, taking into consideration the recommendation of the legislative auditor, CSER's current funding of $1,575 should be increased for inflation and impact of the past 14 years to $21.50, an increase of $5.67. And the reasons are listed on the slide. The reasons are listed on the slide to fulfill the intent of the legislature and the mandate of 2004 IDEA. To provide competitive salaries to attract and retain qualified specialists, to continue providing qualified services for low-incidence disability children with low-incidence disabilities, and to maintain a consistent infrastructure despite short-term or discontinued grant funding cycles. Moving on to slide six. Slide six shows the decline in enrollment. And that's the red graph, between 2001 and 2013, which impacts CSER funding, but also captures the increase in the number of LID students in blue. So the increasing LID students also means increasing expectation of service from school districts. And when you combine that with the shortage of special education teachers and many new special education directors to the state, we have a greater demand for guidance, support, and training. I'm going to move on to slide number 7.
Mr. Perlet, we have a question from Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question about this chart here and the blue line going up, which is the student count, and the red one, ADM. Does this mean a shift in services from, or are there more students who are not being served?
This shows the greater number of students, the greater number of referrals that we are receiving from school districts. And part of that is because of the rising numbers of autism and multiple disabilities. So it's capturing the increasing number of students. Like, for instance, in 2001, we were serving 180 students. And in 2013, we had 260 listed on the chart. And we have referrals for another 6. So we are now up to 266 students being served.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Gardner. Yeah, please continue, Mr. Play.
All right, thank you. So the blue line shows the increasing number of students, and the red line shows the the funding based on declining ADM. So I'll move to slide 7. Slide 7 shows the declining enrollment of ADM saw CISO lose $212,847 between 2004 and 2013. Just in declining enrollment. In addition, we experience inflation while being flat funded. So this shows that we have to do so much more with less funding just based on fluctuating ADM, while at the same time our low incidence population is increasing. And I'll move on to slide 8. And this chart shows CESA's flat funding in comparison to funding increases of 36% for inflation, and roughly 45% if we were funded at percentage increases to base student allocation. So the purple line shows the flat funding of CESA, and the red line shows the consumer price index at 36%, and the green line shows the base student allocation of roughly 45% that school districts have received. And moving on to slide 9. And this chart adds the LID student count to actual funding, and that's the actual funding is in blue, and the increasing student count that we just spoke about is shown in green. And what the funding would have been if we had received funding in sync with base student allocation. But as you can see with the blue line, our actual funding is actually declining while our student numbers are increasing. And I'll move on to slide 10. And slide 10 contrasts CESA's increasing low-incidence disability cost of operations, which is in red, against grant fluctuation, which is in purple, and declining fund balance, which is in green. In 2010 and 2011, we held two ILP grants. One was the early intervention for vision, and the second was the early intervention for hearing impairment. The vision grant we held for over 20 years, and the hearing impairment grant for at least 8 years, and due to funding cuts, both those grants went away, and so we lost that funding. In addition, the Alaska Autism Resource Center lost $84,000 in funding, and that was a mid-year loss, so we had to make adjustments for that, and we ended up closing our satellite office in Fairbanks. And because it was a mid-year adjustment, we had already promised services to school districts, so a board decision was to not cut back services, so LID absorbed an overage of cost there, about $15,000. And strategically, by underspending and reducing specialists to create a fund balance for the uncertainty of reauthorization and increased funding is really a double-edged sword, because we do not meet district funding, we do not meet district demand for service. We burn out our hard-to-recruit specialists, and then we falsely come across like we have surplus revenue. So it really is a tough situation balancing that. And moving on to slide 11.
Mr. Way, a question from Senator Gardner.
Thank you.
Sure.
Can you tell me what happened to cause the loss of autism funding mid-year?
I think it was the Department of Health and Social Services. They had federal funding that they anticipated that didn't come in, and so they cut some of their funding, because the Alaska Autism Resource Center gets different revenue streams. We get some money from the Mental Health Health Trust. We get some money from the Department of Education, and then some money from the Department of Health and Social Services. And so the money that they anticipated coming in was impacted on at the federal end, and so we received less funding to the Alaska Autism Resource Center. And that brings up another issue that's difficult as well, because when we apply for the grant in March or April, when we get our letter of intent, we basically go forth with planning for operations. And then we get an initial award, which often is not the amount of the full grant that we wrote for. And then we get an adjustment in the next stage, and then we have the final award. So it really is a moving target in terms of issuing contracts in March. And that's where, and I'll address that with a slide later on, if we had good infrastructure in the LID, we would have monies to absorb changes in grants.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. Other questions? Please continue, Mr. Blatt.
Okay. Moving on then to slide 11, and this also is in response to the question that I just received. So the green pyramid reflects adequate funding to meet legislative intent of a free and appropriate public education to students with low incidence disabilities. And it provides a good infrastructure upon which to build grant funding. And the example I cited with loss of funding mid-year is a good example for that. And it also meets the state's needs under other appropriate services listed in the statute. The red pyramid makes necessary reduction of LID services to spread FTE over short-term and poorly funded grants. And the result is doing more at the expense of LID services and the quality of service provision. And what I mean by that is every now and again we'll get special projects from the Department of Education saying, would you be able to help us with positive behavioral support or a different grant? But if those are one-year grants, it's very hard to recruit someone for 1 year. So what we end up doing is creating a partial FTE across the low-incidence disability program and the grants program. And one of the things that impacts us when we're recruiting at that point is, for instance, explaining to someone that we have sunset and we can't promise that we'll be in operation after a certain date. And then when we mention the fact that our specialist dependent insurance is only 70% coverage, and like I pointed out, that's about $800 out of pocket, we lose a lot of quality applicants because, you know, they can go across the Anchorage School District, earn 15% more, and have full health coverage. So that's why the structure of the Green Pyramid is so much better, because it provides a better infrastructure to build the agency, to plan strategically for the 8 years of funding. And moving on to slide 12. So the impacts primarily to teachers, aides, and parents is in the form of less assistance with evidence-based practices that we could help them with, targeted interventions, especially with the low-incidence disabilities population, guidance to new special education teachers, and we get many calls from special education teachers who say, I'm newly graduated, I'm in a rural location, but I've never worked with a child who's deafblind before. Could you provide some help? And we get a similar call from the special education director as well. We also will not be able to do modeling of strategies on site. And for many of the teacher aides, the paraprofessionals who do not have formal education or graduate education or college education, for them the best way of showing them how to work with a child is to be on site and to demonstrate it to them. Just lecturing to them, presenting, or sending in a report really does not help them very much. And then recruitment and retention of quality specialists, and I just mentioned that as well. It's becoming more and more difficult to recruit specialists, especially since they've rollover contracts for 3 years, and with the younger folks being more portable with Tier 3 pension, they'll be more inclined to move rather than waiting to be vested. And also presentation at the Alaska Statewide Special Education Conference. This year, CESA specialists are doing 15 presentations, and so that would be a loss. And a major loss would be we are listed both on the Department of Education's website and in the Special Education Handbook as a resource to school districts for low-incidence disabilities. And so if CESA were not reauthorized or didn't have adequate funding, that would be impacted because it would be removing a state resource. And that's all I had at this time, but I wanted to thank you for your time, and I ask on behalf of the CESA Board for your considered support of reauthorization and full funding, and I'm available for any questions that you might have.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation, Patrick. Please, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pillay, just a couple of questions. CESA is unique to Alaska, or excuse my memory, but could you help us out? Are we just an extension of a national or international program?
No, actually, each state has an organization such as CESA, which is responsible for what we do, and that's professional development and training for teachers and paraprofessionals. In fact, I'm in Austin right now at a training for PEPNET, which is the National Organization for Deaf Education. And I am meeting people from organizations like CESA in different parts of the country. So every state has an organization like CESA.
Right. So if what state counterpart-wise and task are kind of parallel to Alaska?
Most of the states have a rural component. I've spoken to people from Kentucky who have rural. I've spoken to people from Washington State that have rural. In terms of the travel, the amount of travel necessitated through use of plane and boat, probably Hawaii, because of the small communities in remote islands, that would be probably the closest match in terms of travel. But in terms of training and working with teachers and paraprofessionals, almost every state has that rural component. Maine, the state of Maine, also does a lot of outreach to rural areas as well.
Yeah, and Patrick, let me ask you, you know, as I recall, and correct me if I say something wrong, because, I mean, I don't see anybody in the Senate, but particularly sitting on this committee, that doesn't believe that we need to do all we can within our capacity and capability to take care of each and every child. Having said that, the way I understand our system is we give X amount of dollars to a school district, all right, and then in some school districts there's a chargeback for special education services, all right. I'll take one I know about. In Mat-Su, if you are you have special ed children that are in a charter school, the school district charges the charter school special education services charge. Is that practiced any place where you have your people going to sites where, and let's just say that, are there some places that do not have special education capability in an individual that's trained professionally?
Every site has a special education teacher. If there are students requiring special education, then the school district has their special education teacher. The larger issue is that special education has such a spectrum of disabilities and disability areas that quite often you'll have in a school a qualified special education teacher with a master's degree and has taken one class in, let's say, deafblindness or one class in autism. And suddenly they are working with a child who's profoundly deaf or needs a sign language interpreter. So intensive funding would allow for a sign language interpreter to be hired. But in a rural location, the individual who applies for that job is applying because they need a job and they're not intrinsically motivated to be a sign language interpreter. Now, the district has already advertised and cannot recruit anyone. So then they would call an agency such as CESA, who would work with that qualified special education teacher to teach sign language and to provide a system for the aide in the school to learn sign language. And the special education guidelines is that anyone who accepts that position as a interpreter in a school district has to move from novice to advanced within a certain period of time. So the school district is now charged with having to provide that professional development, and since they don't have the money to send the person out of state for training, they would contact CESA. We would go in and train that individual and then help them connect with the Alaska State School for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing to complete the SCPI, which is the Sign Communication Proficiency Interview. And all of that documentation then helps the school meet their compliance needs and monitoring through the Department of Education. So to answer the question, yes, there is a special education person on site, but then they don't have the skill set necessary for what's required on site.
Please go ahead, sir.
Follow-up, please. So, Mr. Play, as I see it, in 2013, you have 260 students that you have identified that are being served by CESA. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Are there clumps of that 260, I mean, that are multiples at one location? I mean, what's the distribution look like?
The distribution varies from site to site, and the largest clumps will be. So let me go back to the creation of CESA. CESA was created to serve what was then called the rural attendance areas, and since then, we also serve the major areas. Like for instance, we did a training recently for 269 paraprofessionals in the Mat-Su School District. So the training sometimes can be for larger numbers, which are in the bigger districts. But then you have Bering Strait School District, which is so spread out that we have large numbers. We have in excess of 20 students that we are serving in the Bering Strait School Districts because they are in the various villages, and the special ed director is so far away from those individual villages that they usually call us and say, would you be able to provide services? Another example would be probably Petersburg, where you have a large number of children with autism in excess of 8. So what we do on a site like that is instead of providing itinerant services to each one of the children, we customize the training for the entire staff working with the children with autism, and we provide services there. So it could fluctuate from 1 in a district to about 20 in a district, depending on the isolation of the district and the size.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And Eric gave me a copy of the distribution, and I'm going to ask you a question. Use the example of follow up.
Yeah, please, Senator.
The follow up on use the example of sign language. Now, I'm going to use what I perceive in our three children. They're not special education, so it may not be fair, but I'll just use that parallel.
Sure.
That they would rather sit with a handheld device and learn something than have mom or dad or teacher coax them through a system. So, I mean, I guess I would take your example and say, that electronically delivering that may in fact be a efficient and maybe more effective way, assisted by, you know, whomever is present. But is that kind of true or not true? Or, and my point I'm getting at in the long term is that it appears to me that hopefully we can jump out of the 1960s approach to what we're doing, where a person gets on an airplane, flies to a site, to something that maybe is a bit more efficient, I would hope more effective. Wouldn't want to do something that's not more effective, but help me out on that.
I think that there definitely is a place for technology, and we are also at CESA moving in the direction of distance education, and we use video teleconferencing, we use Skype, and different things. But to come back to the specific example, it would depend a lot on the language that the child has. For instance, if a child is hard of hearing, they would be acquiring some language and learning some. If a child is profoundly deaf, a child will not acquire language through the auditory means because of the deafness. So having a device in front of them would be meaningless in the beginning because they don't have any language. The way I usually explain it when I do trainings in school districts is, if you have an empty jar and if you have a child who's profoundly deaf, and if you taught them three words, those three words would go into that jar. Then when you turn around and ask them a question, they can answer your question only with those three words in the jar. And so in other words, when those words come out, you then work with those words to anchor them, to classify them. For instance, if a profoundly deaf child went to a motor mechanics class in the morning, then went to a baking class, and then went to an English class, in the English class they would write a sentence like, "My mother engine bake," because there's no classification of those words or anchored into any kind of categories. So a child like that would need intensive language learning, and the difficulty with the deaf child is that they are dealing with content at the same time that they're learning the language because there was no natural language acquisition. So in situations like that, you really need an aide who's trained in how to tutor and how to teach a child basic language until they have enough words to then understand the simple instructions. So it's really like Lego, building blocks slowly until they have enough language. And then when they do have enough language, you can match a electronic device to that level, and they could then self-learn at that point. But nationally, many deaf children graduate with a reading level of fourth grade. And that's why the critical language learning window is up to about five. And so with profoundly deaf children, even if you have a teacher with a master's degree, but if they've not worked with a child with deaf education, it's difficult. And I'll throw in one example. I went once into a classroom of a very well-meaning teacher, and they were three-quarter way through a novel with three profoundly deaf children in the classroom. And she was so excited telling me that she was doing this work. And I gently explained to her the difficulty of language acquisition for profoundly deaf kids. I flipped the novel over, and on the back, there was two sentences. It took me 45 minutes to have those two sentences on the board and to give those kids partial understanding of those sentences. But yet the teacher, who has a degree in special education, was already quarter way or three-quarter way through the novel, because the kids do their head nodding like they understand, and you present them with cues, they follow the cues, but there's no real comprehension. So the use of the devices is really matched to the learning potential, the comprehension level, and language level of the students.
Patrick, thank you very much, and you've really helped me, but I have one final question for you. And I'm looking at the map that shows the distribution of students served, and I look at Anchorage as an example, and it shows four. I look at Ketchikan, it shows 19. I mean, I have a hard time figuring out why the disparity in the numbers based on demographics would be like that.
And that's only because the Anchorage School District has enough personnel of their own to handle their own special ed needs. The one area that they feel that they do not have the level of expertise that they need is with deafblind students. So the four that you see there are deafblind students that the Anchorage School District has. They have the teacher of the visually impaired, but CESA has a deafblind specialist, and that deafblind specialist consults with the Anchorage School District. The same would be true of MATSU, because there would be fewer students showing up. There would be more deafblind students, but the training that we did for the 265 paraprofessionals would show up on training. It would not show up on the itinerant services provided to on the map that you have. So that's not training. That's just LID consultation.
I'm not sure I understood that. I mean, there's five times as many students being served in Ketchikan. Ketchikan has the same BSA. I don't know who they hire and what their hiring practices are, but that seems to be a major disparity. I have no idea how many kids are in Ketchikan. I know they're great people there. I'm not trying to pick on them, but the number is way out of tilt, it appears.
Well, and that's because in Ketchikan, the numbers reflect kids who are deaf, kids who have autism, and kids who have multiple disabilities, and kids who have vision impairment. So although Ketchikan has special education teachers, CESA has specialists who have endorsement in those particular areas. And generally, when a child is being served who has vision loss or autism, you would like to have someone on the program who has an endorsement in that specialty area. So although the special education teacher has a generic special education degree, they don't have an autism endorsement. So Ketchikan uses us for consultation to their teachers and for itinerant services. Whereas Anchorage School District, being a larger district, they have their special education teachers, and many of them have the endorsements required to provide the services. So other than deafblindness, Anchorage does not ask CESA for services in any of the other disability areas.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Senator Huggins. Well, complex issue, and at some point I think we need to hear from the department as well. Yes, and just for the record, we have Senator Dunleavy, Senator Huggins, Stevens, and Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Senator Patrick. This is Senator Dunleavy. Just a quick question.
Absolutely.
I want to make sure that I've got this right. So you'll work with teachers, you'll train teachers and paraprofessionals, correct?
Correct.
Do you ever work with and train parents?
Absolutely, all of the time. We try to, first the teachers as part of the IEP team are always involved. And whenever we do the trainings, we have the parents come in as well, because we need to have the transfer of the strategies between the home and the school.
Is there anything in statute or in your mission that would prevent you from training parents directly?
No, I don't think so, because A, on our statute, talks about itinerant services. B, talks about professional development and training. But C, is other services as appropriate. So, and the parent is always a part of the IEP team, so I don't see anything that would prevent us from training a parent directly.
So, for example, if you had an individual that fit the category of child, and they were in a school, public school, but something happened, change in family situation or a health issue, and the child was taken out of school but still needed services, would you still be able to work with that parent?
I think so. I think in the past we have done so, but it was sometimes the constraints of funding to be able to reach everyone. But I think with adequate funding, I don't see anything that prevents us. And that, of course, is a board decision as well. But there's nothing in the statute that prevents us from working directly with a parent.
Thank you. And one last question. What state would you say, from your perspective, has a model CESA-like program?
Hawaii does. I know because they provide services right up to the Marshall Islands and all of that. Hawaii does. I know Vermont does as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. A further question, Senator Gardner.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I'm sort of curious about the linkage between the availability of qualified special ed teachers and the need for CESA services. And I believe that some years ago we changed our statute and allowed teachers to take the special ed certification off their teacher license so that they couldn't be transferred to a special ed classroom what they didn't want. So do we know if school districts across the state generally are able to hire as many special ed teachers as they need? I mean, is one way of providing services maybe to increase the pool of qualified special ed teachers directly to the district, and that would reduce the need for CESA services?
No, thank you.
I think it's a little bit of the opposite, because number one, there's a national shortage of special education teachers, and I know a couple of years ago, as recently as last year, we had many unfilled special education positions. And then when you look at what prompts a special education teacher to not want the endorsement on their certificate, and that's because many of them perceive the stresses of being a special education teacher because of the demands of paperwork and the different things that they have to learn, and then the variability of having a training but then encountering a syndrome or a disability for the first time. There was a study done last year by a professor out of University of Fairbanks that showed that I think it was 78% of special ed teachers who felt they were not adequately prepared just because of the vast demands of the field. Now, in Alaska, we have the waiver program that allows general ed teachers to enter special ed after taking some coursework, and that's where I made the comment that it's somewhat of the opposite, because many of those teachers, if they have a general ed background and then they do a short intensive program in special education through the waiver process and then enter the field of special education, that's where we get most of our calls, because teachers will call and say, I do have a special ed background, but I don't have any background in this particular disability. Can you hear me? Can you help me? And then also, I'm thinking of an example with Senator Dunleavy's question. Last year, we had a parent from Fairbanks who had a child with CHARGE syndrome, and CHARGE syndrome has many anomalies. I mean, you have heart condition, you have hearing loss, you have vision loss, and many of the children don't live beyond 16 or 17 years of age. And so when she called and was really concerned, and one of the things I realized was that she didn't have a ceiling of what the potential was for her child. So we actually paid for her to go down to Florida to attend the CHARGE syndrome conference. And she was surrounded by other parents who had children with CHARGE syndrome and saw children who were successful. And I think that's a good example of other services as appropriate. And there's such a gamut. And then to come back to the question, when we have teachers who come into the classrooms and they don't have the adequate background, that's where there's a tremendous need for CESA services.
Thank you. And I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please continue.
Would you hazard a guess or do you know what percentage of the students that you serve are likely to be successful enough in high school to get a diploma?
About 68% of our caseload is intensive, and many of those kids are also they also do well, but it would be hard to guess an exact number, because it would depend on what their disability was, what the cognitive level was, and what progress they were making towards a diploma. But there is I wouldn't want to venture a number. That might be something I could check with the Department of Ed and get back to you on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
It's Senator Dunleavy.
Patrick, Senator Dunleavy again. Do you have or have you had any situations where you've had a direct relationship with a student's ILP? In other words, that you folks serviced the ILP?
ILP, no, we haven't had any infant learning program. I mean, we've had two grants. We've had the vision services and the hearing services, where we've had specialists who go in and work with parents and provide them assistance on, like, for instance, if for the first time, if the child has a hearing loss, they'll be wearing hearing aids. If it's vision loss, the different devices that they will be using. So it's direct services in trying to elevate the skill level of the parent. And most often, when we do have a grant like that, it's in support to the ILP specialists who may not have that level of expertise. So it's going with them and dual training. So it's training the parents and then providing the ILP provider with that expertise as well. Because there's 18 regional ILP providers across the state, and CESA will often do training for them during their general meetings in Anchorage or when we go out. So to answer your question, we do both. We would work individually with the parent, but most often it's working with the ILP provider who's receiving that training on site as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks for the questions. If you'd hold on and continue to be available, Patrick, I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
And Tim will get back to the issue of the CS, but could I ask the department to come forward and give us their perspective, if you don't mind? And I guess my question is that I think I have a vague understanding of how this all works, but the actual line drawn between CESA and the department and the districts is a little vague to me. So could you tell us What happened? Now, our job here today in this bill is talk about extension of the sunset, but also talk about funding. So could you tell me what happens in your view without CISA? What is the impact on the district? So what is the impact on the department? And I realize that you're not the funding is going through you, and you have really, it looks to me like, limited responsibility to CISA other than to pass the funding along. But I appreciate the reflection from the department on this issue.
Right. Thank you, Chair Stevens. And for the record, I'm Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance. In response to the question, what would the state look like without CISA, I think that, you know, Patrick answered a lot of what CISA does. The department is very supportive of this agency in that they really provide a statewide capacity to step in and fill the gaps when services are needed. And I think one of the large points that Patrick made was that you may need services in one town in November that you didn't know about previously, and so CISA has the capacity, they have the specialists on board that they can go out and fill in those needs. And I think that, you know, he pointed to some efficiencies that I would agree with, in that not every district is going to have every specialist that they may need from one year to the next. So this would afford a smaller district to reach out to CISA and ask for some special services to come in and help them with, you know, the cohort of students that they have that year. And the following year, they may be different specialists that are needed. So from the department standpoint, I don't know who would, you know, fill that void if CISA was not there to send, you know, deaf and hearing specialists to a district who is servicing their first deaf student in 5 years.
Thank you. Any further explanation on that issue or other issues? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's interesting to me, I mean, this is my first contact with CISA. I didn't know they existed. But it's interesting, if this is a critical function that's across the states, why they aren't part of your wiring diagram and they work for the commissioner. I'm looking at the criticality. And first part. The second part is that, I don't know, I think we're like 24th internationally in math. Why don't we have the math CISA? I'm just looking at, you know, how we develop things, and in this case, I'll call it supplementary to Department of Ed. Why aren't they the most critical or second most critical? And, oh, by the way, the commissioner has full control over them. Help me out.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Huggins. You know, I think that there could be various diagrams of where to place these services in the state of Alaska. How they came to be at Department of Education and Health and Social Services, I'm sorry that I don't know all the history of that. I think that wherever they are, there's going to be a link to a set of services. So the Department of Education, we have the link to the school districts, and so it does make some sense to me that we have some oversight and some interaction with CISA. It's, you know, structurally their funding comes through the education budget. Could that be done differently? You know, I think that, you know, maybe there's a proposal that out there that could have that done differently. It's working in the way that it's meant to have the department provide that funding out to CESA. The department also reviews CESA's budget. We review their annual audit when they turn that in. And then our director of special ed is a member of their oversight committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman. The other one, and I'm testing my memory, so you feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but when we in the past 5 years were kind of peeling back the onion, looking at variables of funding and demands of capability, Juneau, as I recall, as a hub city, had the highest per capita requirement for services for children in the school district. And yet I see that Juneau only requires or has three people that's having assistance from CESA, and we're in Juneau. Could you tell me what's the variable there? If by far, I mean, do they have the most robust special ed program with Superwoman heading it, or what's the variable?
Thank you, and through the chair, Senator Huggins. My understanding of CESA is that they have the capacity that when they're called upon, they are able to take their staff and take a specialist out to an area that may not have that specialty available in a community. So CESA's mission is really more toward serving smaller communities that don't have the specialists that a larger community would have. And I guess in my mind, I would maybe think of it as a community hospital versus being in a community that had a very large medical community. CESA has specialists that can go out and support smaller communities who may have general special ed teachers, very good special ed teachers, but they may not have worked with a specific disability that a student enters their classes with. They may not have seen that disability for 5 years, so CESA is able to go out and add that specialist knowledge to the existing special education teacher in the community. And so in Juneau's case, larger community, more of an economy of scale, Juneau may already have a special ed teacher that can teach to autism, a special ed teacher that could teach to the deaf and hearing.
I'm not trying to pick at you on the math, but I have this little map in front of me, and it shows that Ketchikan has a demand of 19 students, and Juneau has a demand of 3 students. And if you accept my bottom line that, oh, by the way, Juneau has a much larger number of students, and I don't know the difference between the population in Ketchikan and Juneau, but it's probably not huge, not like Anchorage and Ketchikan, but there's 6 times as much demand on the system from CESA, from Ketchikan, than there is in Juneau. There has to be some correlation of how we're doing business differently. If it's the community's kind of not disproportionately larger, but a little bit bigger, but if you accept my theorem of information that Juneau has this huge number of students being a hub city, how you could have 6 times the demand on CESA and Ketchikan.
And through the chair, Senator Huggins, if I could try to clarify, my understanding is that it would be the expectation that CESA would serve communities with smaller enrollments because those communities don't have as many specialists in the community. So it would be my understanding that really the mission of CESA is to spread themselves across the state and inject specialty services into small communities that may not have those services in the community. And that given that model, then it wouldn't surprise me that they did not serve as many students in our hub communities.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. And I Mr. Chairman, the one thing I would ask is we could just get a, you know, just a round number of how many special ed teachers we have in Juneau versus Ketchikan, and then the number of students being serviced in each of those communities. Because the number just seems to be disproportionate. But anyway.
Well, it's a very interesting issue, I think, and I appreciate the questions. I think the question still is, what would you do without them, and how would the state survive? How would the districts and the department adjust should CESA be sunsetted, for example? As I understand it, maybe we need to know a little bit more about how the districts work, and if you as a district have a certain number of special ed teachers and you get funding for those special ed teachers, how does it work then if you bring in CESA for more of your needs? I guess I don't really understand how the districts decide what to do. I'm looking at Kodiak, for example. I know we have a large special ed number of teachers there, and I know they deal with the villages, and it looks like it's at six. If I were a superintendent, why wouldn't I call more upon CESA, because it wouldn't take money out of my budget? Am I understanding that right, or am I wrong on that? Does the money come out of my budget in the end? The CESA charge back to my district, for example, or maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Chair Stevens, and I would, welcome Patrick to clarify, but my understanding is that the services that CESA provides are not charged back to the districts, because the districts have used their funding to hire a special ed teacher. That teacher may be under contract. They have hired a one-on-one aide, and they have been serving perhaps, three students with autism, and a student presents themselves with hearing difficulties, and in order to get the technical services to train the existing and incoming staff for that specific disability, they call on CESA for additional support.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Elizabeth. I would think Ketchikan and Kodiak are probably pretty similar in size, but interesting that disparity between the two. Would you go on and talk about one other issue that I'd like to learn more about, and that's the, and I'm not sure if you're the one to ask this or not, Elizabeth, the comparing special ed teachers in a district to special ed teachers in CESA. We've heard that there's a difference in maybe benefits or retirement, or what is the difference, the cost between those two? Are we spending more money in our districts on a special ed teacher than we are through CESA? And that's what I seem to have heard.
Elizabeth, would you like me to answer that?
Yes, if you would, please. Yes. I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
Sure. This is Patrick. We actually spend less on CESA specialists because school districts' employees get full medical benefits, and also CESA specialists have not had the benefit of the increases that have been given to salary increases that have been given to teachers because of our flat funding. The other thing that CESA specialists bring is they bring a high level of specialty in each of their disability areas. So when we recruit specialists, we recruit them for their extended experience in specific areas, because we need them to know more than classroom teachers. And also, going back to the example of Kodiak, although Kodiak has many special education teachers, an example would be, let's say they have a special ed teacher who has some experience with vision loss, but they need a child who needs a Braille or needs a specific technology device like an iPad, and what are the programs that are being used. And that's the expertise that CESA specialists would bring in. Now, I know last year we did a training for all of the teachers who work with autism on Kodiak Island. And I know myself, I have done a training for all of the teachers in the middle school and upper high school on working with kids on hearing loss. So that was myself as a CESA specialist training the entire middle school and upper school teachers. And does that answer the question? I'm sorry.
Yes, it does, Patrick. If I understand it, then the increase in funding that's being asked for, going from 1575 to 2150, that increase of 5.65, would one of the goals there is to bring the teachers up in CESA up to where they are in the district and to make it more competitive and more fair. Is that true?
That is true. The two main ones would be salary increases, because they've rolled over contracts for 3 years, and possibly look at benefit increases down the line. Because one of the other things that I've always felt is unfair is that, I use the word unfair, but CESA specialists, because we are not a school district, so even if they taught at CESA for 15 years and they wanted to move into a school district, they wouldn't get those years of service in a school district, because they are in a non-profit organization. And their sick leave also, if they were not sick and had a number of days to transfer in, they wouldn't be able to transfer that in. So considering that, all of those things, and the fact that if they had 70% dependent coverage and had to pay 30% out of pocket, these are individuals that would be in very, very rural locations when they got a phone call from a spouse to say that their child or spouse was not well. And I think it's just hard on them when the first thing they think about is how much it's going to cost when they are out in a remote location and not even present with the individual that's not well. And so I think a funding increase would make it equitable for them to see CESA as an organization that they could stay with for a long term.
Thank you, Patrick. And back to Elizabeth, just you know, we've talked about the diagramming this in the department. It could change. You know, certainly, we could change that. You could request a change. There could be a different way of diagramming it, but we'd want to accomplish the same goals. And you know, so the way I'm sort of looking at it now is that we have a system that works. Maybe it's best not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and try to find a way to make it competitive and continue to do the job they're doing. Any reflection on that before we
thank you for your comments?
Well, Chair Stevens, I can see how you would have gotten to that conclusion. So it would be a reasonable conclusion.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, any questions of the department? Senator Huggins. Thank you.
But for Patrick.
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, Patrick, Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla. I've got my mind's eye listening to our discussion on this in a couple of committee meetings, that the people that you have on your staff, I'm going to call them super special education qualified kinds of people. Is that kind of am I seeing it correctly, or correct me if I'm wrong?
Yep, Senator Huggins, through the chair. I think that would be correct, and I will give you the reasons why. I think one of the greatest benefits that CESA specialists have in their role is that they go from classroom to classroom and school to school within districts, and they learn from special education teachers as much as they teach special education teachers. And then they take that information in their toolkit and they share it on a different site. So what you have is, and that goes back to one of the goals of the legislature, is to create cooperation in special education between districts. And so what we have is a specialist will go to a district and a teacher will ask a particular question, and they'll say, you know, I've seen this done in Ketchikan, or I've seen this done in Barrow in this particular way, and here's the teacher that you can talk to, and let me show you what they've done, and let me show you using my iPad some of the pictures. So I think you do become super specialists because of your exposure and your ability to learn from each other. And one of the examples I shared the last time, I took many classes in audiology, but it was actually a parent who taught me that a child should take their shower in the evening so the ear can dry out before you put the hearing aid on in the morning to prevent moisture and otitis media. And that is something that I learned from a parent on a site, and I was able to share with many parents at other sites. So it's the exposure that creates the ability to have that greater knowledge and skill set.
Follow-up. Patrick, do you have many people that are on your special ed staff that are retiree rehires? Because, I mean, that appears to me, I'll take the teacher mentor program, all right? If I've got it right, that the teacher mentor kinds of people probably have served 20 or 30 years in a school district, and they're now got some additional qualifications, and they're not the same subject matter area, but they're kind of rotating around helping new fledgling teachers or, you know, some special requirement in an area. But back to the question of retiree rehires. Are many people retiree rehires?
We actually have burnt our fingers a little bit doing some of that, and I don't mean that to be a blanket statement. Number one, the CISA specialists have a high degree of travel. They sleep on floors. They are traveling in very cold conditions. They are standing on runways for school district personnel to pick them up. So if it's something that you really do not enjoy doing, it can burn out pretty quickly. In the last few years of hiring, because of flat funding to CISA, I've had two main groups of applicants. The first group is brand new graduates who are willing to do anything because they need a job, but unfortunately they don't have the experience to know more than special education teachers and to be able to assist them. The second group was retirees from out of state who are wanting to see Alaska. And they look great on resume, and you talk to them, and they are wonderful, and then you hire them. And I've had two that basically started in August and then checked out in January and were waiting for the rest of the year to finish so they could leave. So I'm very careful now that if I'm looking at a retiree, I'm looking at someone who enjoys the travel, enjoys every aspect of hardship that CISA specialists have to endure to be able to get out to the sites. So we have looked at that. It has worked in some cases, and it has not in others.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Huggins. We have several experts in the audience here, and I'd like to invite anyone to come up if they would care to make some comments at this time. Sir?
Thank you, Eric.
All right. For the record, Eric Gebhardt, superintendent of Nenana City School District and chair of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I think I can help a little bit with the numbers in regards to the map. And part of it is it's with the experts that you have in place compared to the need that you have in place. So, again, I'm not familiar with Juneau or Ketchikan in particular, but I am familiar with Nenana. And in Nenana, the number is zero. There's nothing there as far as CISA services go. All right? However, we do have a small number of kids that actually would qualify for help in autism if we needed it. However, the superintendent in Nenana, the special education director in Nenana, and then we have a special education teacher in Nenana, we have expertise in autism that allows us to take care of the kids that we have. It's not that we wouldn't qualify for CISA services in Nenana. We just, at this point, don't need them. Somewhere down the road, when I retire, when my special education teacher and director leave, you know, that may change. And we may have the same students that we have now, but if we lose our expertise because we go somewhere, then Nenana will call CISA, will appear on the map. Here in Juneau, I think you were actually hitting right on it when you were saying, you know, they have a wide array of expertise, they're a hub city, they have a lot of what they need. So it doesn't mean that they don't have students that wouldn't qualify for CISA. They just, based on the expertise that they have available to them in their school district, they just don't need to call on CISA. So the purpose of CISA is to be is to go to the places where the experts are not. As a state, we do have expertise. And, you know, and sometimes those experts show up in rural places, you know. And so we'd have to take a specific look at, because LID is not a, you know, I mean, LID is a general category, but inside LID, there's all these different things. So even when you talk about CESA specialists being super specialists, they're super specialists in their area. I'll pick on Patrick because I'm his boss and I can do that. You know, we know he is an expert in deaf and blindness, okay? And he may or may not, I don't know him well enough, but like say all of us in Nenana left and we needed help on autism, Patrick's probably not the one who's going to come. I mean, one, because he's executive director, but if he was a specialist, we would get an autism specialist, not a, you know, in a different category. So that's the other part of what CESA does, is we have specialists in certain areas, and is it possible that we could end up with a student in our state where we don't have particular expertise at CESA? Yeah, but if we got that challenge, somebody would have to take it on. Somebody would have to learn, get the training, you know, and learn on the go as we do. Does that help a little bit more?
It does. It does.
With that?
Okay. Please. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eric, it's fun to talk to you and enjoy your passion. Homeschoolers. What's the demand of homeschoolers in a place like Mat-Su to get in touch with Patrick for services? I'm a homeschool parent.
Right.
And there's a bunch of them.
Right. And I mean that
they have disabled children, just like you know, those who go into public, you know, going to Wasilla High School. How do they plug into this system?
Well, if they're affiliated with a statewide program, for instance, in Nenana we have a statewide program, and we actually have a special education teacher in every office that we have. So through the special education teacher, if there was a qualifying need, then it would follow the same procedure. And from the teacher to the director to the referral and all the way back to, yeah, to where the person was.
Yeah, I guess for yourself and Patrick, I would like to see the number of homeschool students and parents that are receiving some sort of services through CESA
okay.
in Mat-Su.
I'm
going to get asked that question one of
right.
the days.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I don't – Patrick, do you know offhand?
No, I don't know offhand. I know we have kids who are medically fragile at home. I don't know off the top of my head the requests we've had from homeschooled kids. Or parents. I know that there's been one or two, and we've sent information to them that they've requested. I remember a couple on deaf education and multiple disabilities, but I don't know the number that, off the top of my head, that we serve right now. I can look into that.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Thank you. And thank you, Eric. Appreciate it.
Okay. If I could just please. Another just hearing the questions from the back and wishing so. The other thing on contracts and salaries and such is every school district actually, as well as CESA, you know, we negotiate our own individual contracts. In Nenana, we do pay 100% of the health too. Not every district does. AASB actually does a salary survey. And every district gets it. I'm sure that would be available to the legislature. They do it for administrators, teachers, classified, and so that might be something that would be that I was just going to suggest be good information for you to look at what's happening salary-wise at a state level. But what Patrick's talking about, it, you know, our CESA folks are located in Anchorage, so that's where they're based out of, and so that is the district that's our best comparison because that's where they are. So,
thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Eric. So that it's your belief as well as Patrick's when he presented it that we're not quite competitive in CESA with our teachers. They're not receiving the same
benefit package that that special ed teachers in districts receive, and so we need to at least look at funding to bring that up.
Right.
And be more
right. At least in Anchorage. Again, I'm not familiar with every district in the state, but everybody does their own negotiations. So right. You know, it does vary from place to place. But okay. In Anchorage, where CESA is located, you know, that's where our where specialists are needed and wanted and coveted, you know, in larger districts.
Well, thank you, Eric. I'm glad you could be with us today. I know you have some travel plans, but
I get
please
to go
you
home
be here with us. Thank you so much.
Should I call in on Friday too, or be able?
Do we have that scheduled for? Do we have it scheduled for Friday? Pardon me. Yeah. We'll take it up at a later date. We don't really have that scheduled, but we'll let you know on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up for Eric. Does CESA receive any sort of reimbursement from any school district?
No. It's and that's part of the I think it's part of the statute or whatever that CESA provides its services free to districts.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Further comments from anybody? I see some people in the audience. Well, thank you for being here. Patrick, anything you would care to say to wrap things up here?
I think Eric covered everything, and he was correct that CESA is a free service to school districts, so I appreciate your consideration of our bill.
Thank you. We have a CS center in your packet there to look at. I don't think we'll deal with it right now, but there is some language that we think can be taken out without loss of anything. So with that, we're adjourned.
Yeah.
So, it is true.